Heavenly King, Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, present everywhere and filling all things, the treasury of good and giver of life, come and dwell in us and cleanse us from every impurity and save our souls, gracious one.
Okay, thank you, Father, and thank you also to the CYC, the Central Youth Committee, for inviting me to give this presentation tonight, and to also His Grace Bishop Ezekiel for the invitation to give a presentation tonight on the life and work of St. Gregory the Theologian. And his, as you can see, he has the title of the theologian, is only three people in the church who has the honour of being given the title of the theologian, the other two being John the Evangelist, the writer of the Gospel of John, and Simeon, the new theologian, who lived in the 10th and 11th centuries. And as you can see from the quote that I've got on the opening slide, one of the reasons why, or the primary reason why St. Gregory was given the title of the theologian is because of the fundamental contribution he made to the Christian understanding of God as a Trinity. Gregory's greatest devotion in all of life was the doctrine and worship of the Trinity, and much of our traditional understanding of the Trinity comes from Gregory himself. So it was Gregory, more than anyone before him, who made the Trinity the centerpiece and the cardinal doctrine of Christianity. Now, I'll just run through some a quick overview of St. Gregory. He was born around the year 330 in Arianzas. Now, just to give you an idea of where these places are, Arianzas is near another, was just a small village in the wider region called Cappadocia. And it was near another city, small village called Nazianzas, which was also in Cappadocia. Now, although Gregory is sometimes called Gregory of Nazianzas, he was never officially the bishop there. He only assisted his father, who was himself a bishop of Nazianzas there. And we'll come back to that a bit later. So, just to give you a better idea of where these regions are, I have a map here, where you can see where I've highlighted in yellow the two villages, Arianzum or Arianzas and Nazianzas, which was nearby. So Gregory was born in Arianzas, and they were in the wider region called Cappadocia, which is East Turkey now. Okay, now going back to this overview of Gregory, so he was born around the year 330, died around the year 390 at around 60 years of age. He's known, as I said, the theologian, primarily for his contribution to the doctrine of God as a Trinity, and he's had that epithet, that title, since the middle of the 5th century, since the Council of Chalcedon in 451. Now, one of the questions this raises is, what is it to be a theologian? And as Father Chris mentioned, I studied theology at St. Andrew's Theological College in Sydney, and one of the questions you often ask yourself and get asked in class when you're studying theology is, what exactly is theology and what is it to be a theologian? And I think one of the best approaches to take in answering this question is to look at the great theologians of the church to see how they answered this question. And if you look at what St. Gregory had to say, he writes that theology involves not simply learning and intellectual subtlety, but requires a commitment to the entire Christian way of life, and particularly the purification of heart and mind. So this word purification plays a really important role in Gregory's understanding of theology. So he makes a very close connection between theology and knowledge of God on the one hand, and the state or spiritual condition of the theologian on the other. And this is a very characteristic aspect of all of Gregory's writings. He often says that spiritual progress and right belief unavoidably go together. And it's an interesting fact that in terms of sheer volume, Gregory devotes more attention to ascetical and spiritual themes than he does to Christ or the Trinity. So going back to this idea of purification, Gregory highlights purification as a kind of prerequisite for theologizing. And in the quote that I've got here, which is a famous passage in one of his orations or sermons, where he makes a dramatic call for purification. And I'll just read it out. He says, "Discussion of theology is not for everyone, I tell you, not for everyone. It is no such inexpensive or effortless pursuit. Nor, I would add, is it for every occasion or every audience. Neither are all its aspects open to inquiry. It must be reserved for certain occasions, for certain audiences, and certain limits must be observed." And this is the central point, and I've highlighted it. "It is not for all people, but only for those who have been tested and have found a sound footing in study, and more importantly, have undergone, or at the very least are undergoing, purification of body and soul. For one who is not pure, to lay hold of pure things is dangerous, just as it is for weak eyes to look at the sun's brightness." So purification is a prerequisite for theologizing. Knowledge of God is not something that can be acquired and taught irrespective of one's moral and spiritual condition. It belongs only to those who have undergone the costly and difficult process of transformation that Gregory calls purification, or katharsis in Greek, which means a radical change in one's character and way of life. Now, going back to this summary, St. Gregory is also one of the three Cappadocian fathers, together with Basil the Great, who, as I'll mention a bit later, he was very good friends with, and Basil's brother, Gregory of Nyssa. St. Gregory is also well known for his great literary abilities. He's been regarded as a great stylist of classical poetry and prose. And he's also well known for his outstanding rhetorical skills. He and St. John Chrysostom are generally considered the greatest Christian orators in the late antique Greek world, that is the early Byzantine period. And he's sometimes referred to as the Christian Demosthenes. Demosthenes was an Athenian statesman who lived in the 4th century BC. So this is the time of the philosophers Plato and Aristotle. And Demosthenes is regarded as the greatest of the ancient Greek orators, and he's famous for delivering these great speeches over a period of around 30 years, rousing the Athenians to oppose Philip of Macedon and later his son Alexander the Great. And so Demosthenes is regarded as one of the greatest orators of the ancient Greek world, and Gregory is given the title of the Christian Demosthenes. A theme that you'll see in all of Gregory's life is this constant battle or struggle between two different paths that he's faced with: the vita activa, the active or practical life, and the vita contemplativa, the contemplative or ascetic monastic life. There was always this struggle in Gregory as to which path he ought to choose. So on the one hand, he has a kind of a retiring, reclusive temperament, and he always he aspired to be a man of letters, an intellectual, and one of his greatest goals was to create a new body of literature which would be thoroughly Christian and would kind of surpass the achievements of the ancient Greek world. And so one of the things you'll see throughout his life is that whenever there's some great trouble in his life, his first instinctive reaction is to flee, to leave and go to some monastic retreat or somewhere where he can be in solitude and silent prayer. And for him, the contemplative life was the truly philosophical life, and he always regarded, I've got a quote here, the contemplative life to be the one that he really preferred, the one that he was most attracted to. So this is a quote from a sermon he gave when he returned. So I'll come back to this in a minute, but he was ordained as a priest. He wasn't very happy with that. He quickly just took off, and then a bit later he came back to the church that he was meant to be in charge of or helping out, and he gave this kind of defense of why he left. And this is partly what he said. To me, nothing seems preferable to the state of the man who, closing his senses to exterior impressions, escaping from the flesh and the world, re-entering into himself, retaining no further contact with any human beings except when necessity absolutely requires it, conversing with himself and with God, lives beyond visible things and carries within himself the divine images, always pure, untouched by any admixture with the fugitive forms of this earth. But on the other hand, he always had a sense of responsibility to provide leadership for the local church and as well later on for the church in Constantinople, and to assist his father, who was a priest and a bishop himself, and his friend Basil. And I've got a quote here from, this has a translation of his autobiography, which I'll say a few things about a bit later on, but one of the unique things about Gregory is that he left us an autobiography, and there aren't many church fathers who wrote an autobiography. In fact, the only other person who left us with anything like an autobiography is Augustine in the West. And the other unique thing about Gregory is that he wrote his autobiography as a poem. And in fact, he wrote many autobiographical poems, but I'll be referring and quoting from the longest one, the most influential one, which is called De Vita Sua, meaning On My Life or My Life. And he says about this struggle between the active life and the contemplative life, he says, I realized that those who enjoy a practical life, the active life, are useful to others who are in the thick of things, but do not benefit themselves. They are distracted by the wicked too, who disrupt their calm disposition. So there are pros and cons, advantages and disadvantages to the practical active life. On the other hand, Gregory says, those who have withdrawn are in some way more stable and with a tranquil mind can keep their gaze directed towards God. But they only benefit themselves, for their love is a narrow one, and strange and harsh is the life they lead. So again, advantages and disadvantages to the contemplative life. So, Gregory concludes, I chose a middle path between solitude and involvement, adopting the meditative ways of the one and the usefulness of the other. So his solution was to choose a middle way between the two paths. Okay, now, before I go on to Gregory's life itself, I'll just say a few words about the times that he lived in. And this was a time when Christianity was on the rise. It was in the ascendancy. Paganism was on the way out. It was pretty much dead and buried. And this was a time when it was becoming legally and socially possible for the very first time to be a public Christian intellectual. And Christianity under the Emperor Constantine had become the privileged religion. But at the same time, this was a period when the church was racked by all sorts of internal divisions, schisms and heresies that were threatening to undermine the unity of the church. And the greatest of these threats came from a heresy known as Arianism, which originated with someone called Arius, who was a priest in Alexandria in Egypt, and he taught something like what you hear nowadays fairly often, that Jesus was a great man, a great, you know, moral and spiritual leader, but he was not God. And the way Arius put it was that Christ was not consubstantial with God the Father, of the same essence as God the Father. For Arius, Christ was not merely a human being, he was a bit more exalted than that, but not equal with God either. So Arianism was the greatest threat. And interestingly, Gregory indicates in his autobiography that there was also a big contrast at this time between what was happening in the West and what was happening in the East of the Roman Empire. So Rome and the West generally was much more unified than the East, which was more racked by these internal divisions. And I'll just read a short passage from his autobiography about this, where he says, the two Romes, meaning the old Rome in the West and the new Rome, which was Constantinople, okay, the two Romes, one ancient power and one new. With regard to faith, one of them, that is the ancient Rome, has long been and still is on the right path, uniting the whole West by means of the message of salvation, and, as is right for the principal among all the churches, worshipping the whole harmony of God. The other city, the new Rome, Constantinople, once stood upright, but now no longer. Instead, it lay in the depths of destruction. And Gregory goes on to explain that this is largely because of the influence of Arianism. Now, Gregory himself played a very big role in turning this around, as we'll see. And at this stage, there isn't that division that we have now between the Orthodox Church in opposition to the Catholic Church. What you had then was the Orthodox faith in opposition to all these other heresies, like Arianism. And by Orthodox faith, what was meant was the faith of Nicaea, the Council of Nicaea. So I'll come back to this a bit later. Now, Gregory's family, he came from a fairly well-off family that lived, that owned a large estate in rural Cappadocia, in near Azianzus, and which was not far from the larger town of Nazianzus. And in fact, when Gregory ended up going to Constantinople, some of the locals there would make fun of his country accents. So he was very much a provincial person. And they were fairly well off, and this is indicated by Gregory's will. Now, he actually has left us. We still have his will, which is quite remarkable. It's the only will of a church father that has come down to us. And also, it's the oldest extant will made under Roman law. And in his will, he bequeaths most of his resources to the poor of Nazianzus. But he also gives his heir, a deacon Gregory, the sum of 50 gold pieces, solidi. So gold coins were the most stable form of currency in the ancient world. And in the 4th century, soldiers were usually paid a wage of 4 solidi per year. And apparently they were able to live adequately on this income. So for Gregory to give 50 gold pieces to his heir, and this being only a portion of his will, indicates that he's fairly well off. Now, Gregory's father, also called Gregory, he would have been around 50 years old when Gregory was born. He wasn't raised as a Christian. He belonged to a kind of obscure sect that was mixed with Jewish and pagan elements, but which worshipped one God. And he converted to the Christian faith largely as a result of his wife, due to her good example and strong persuasion. And he actually became, when he was around 50 years old, bishop of his native city, Nazianzus. He built a church there for the faithful, and he's generally regarded as a caring and diligent pastor, even though he wasn't, you know, as gifted as a theologian as his son Gregory was. And Gregory provides a very respectful tribute in his autobiography to his father, where he says, "I had a father who was very much a gentleman, an elderly man, simple in his ways, a standard for our life, truly a patriarch, a second Abraham. Not just seeming, but being the best, not like people now. Formerly he had wandered away when he belonged to that sect, but later became Christ's friend, then his shepherd, a bishop, the model of a strong shepherd." And then Gregory goes on to talk about his mother. "And my mother, to describe her briefly, was an equal partner for a man of such qualities, complementing him perfectly. She came from a devout family, even more devout herself, a woman in body, but in her way of life, more than a man. Both of them equally famous, their lives equally matched." So her mother, Nonna, came from a wealthy Christian family. Her brother was a respected lawyer and man of letters. And Gregory calls his mother the spiritual leader, the archivos of the family, and highly extols her Christian virtue. And in his autobiography, Gregory also describes his mother's plea for a son. So she feared that she would bear no male children, and so she promised God that if she bore a son, she would return the gift she had received. And God then granted her a dream of Gregory's appearance and the name he was to have. And when Gregory was born, Nonna dedicated him to God as she had promised. Now, just a summary of Gregory's life. So you can break it up into different stages or phases. And you have in the beginning, up to around 30 years of age, his childhood, his education, and I'll describe all these different phases in more detail in a minute. Then from around 30 to 50, his period as priest and bishop in Nazianzus, followed by a four-year stay in a monastery. Then the most, you could say, important or the most influential period of his life, even though it was the shortest, you know, it actually was only 18 months long when he was Bishop of Constantinople, when also we have the Second Ecumenical Council, the Council of Constantinople in 381. Then he retires and preoccupies himself with ecclesiastical and literary activities back in Nazianzus. All right, well, now I'll just look into, in a bit more detail, Gregory's life. Beginning with his early years, he says in his autobiography that he enjoyed reading and literature. He says, "I enjoyed those books that spoke of God and associated with men of the best character." And a bit later he says, "While my cheek was still beardless, a passionate love of letters possessed me." He had an older sister and a younger brother. His sister, Gorgonia, was a strong woman like her mother. She excelled in ascetical practice and generosity to the poor. She married a senior military officer and they had at least three daughters. His younger brother, Caesarius, he pursued a medical career. He became a senior doctor at the imperial court in Constantinople and he became a fairly wealthy man. But he died fairly young in his mid-30s, even though at this, you know, time the life expectancy wasn't anywhere near what it is today. Still unmarried. And he died in a plague that followed an earthquake. And this came as an enormous shock to Gregory, who later wrote, "I died to the world and the world to me, and I have become a living corpse, as devoid of strength as a dreamer. Since that day, my life is elsewhere." So Gregory's writings are always very dramatic, poetic, literary, and is very honest in his writings as well. His education, one thing his parents gave to both sons was an excellent education, both a classical Greek education and a religious education. So the brothers both studied at their local town in Nazianzus. This Gregory would have been around 13 years of age. And then they soon moved to the capital of Cappadocia, Caesarea, where they studied grammar and rhetoric, which would have been the core subjects of a Greek and Roman education. So grammar is something like learning the rules and parts of speech of language. Rhetoric, which is a very important subject of the time, concerned itself with the art of self-expression and persuasion and argumentation, how to give a talk, a speech, and so on. Then Gregory travelled again with his brother further afield for more study, this time to another Caesarea, maritime Caesarea in Palestine. And you can see it there. It's close to Nazareth, but it's on the Mediterranean Sea. And one writer describes this city as the closest thing in the 4th century to a Christian university town. And the person who wrote this was John McGuckin, who is a contemporary scholar who's written a very comprehensive, and you could say the definitive, biography of St. Gregory, a very thick volume, worth looking at if you're interested in Gregory's life. So maritime Caesarea was a great centre of Christian learning, and this was largely because it was associated with Origen. And Origen was perhaps the leading theologian of the early church. He was a very influential theologian and biblical scholar, and had a great influence on the early church and on Gregory as well. Origen was a priest. He came from Alexandria in Egypt, but then he moved to Palestine, Caesarea, and he established a kind of a group of followers, a school there. And it was there that Gregory came in contact. Origen was long gone by then, but it was there that Gregory came in contact with Origen's works. And we'll see a bit later how Gregory, together with Basil, tried to preserve Origen's legacy. So then Gregory, again with his brother, moves further for more study, this time to Alexandria, the capital of Egypt. Now, Alexandria, as you know, was founded by Alexander the Great until it was given over to the Arab forces in the 7th century. It was one of the greatest cities of the Mediterranean world. It was a centre of economics and commerce, of culture and learning. All major schools of philosophy were well represented there. It was a very cosmopolitan city. It was a melting pot of native Egyptians, Greeks and Jews. It had the largest Jewish population outside of Palestine. And quite often the different ethnic groups didn't get along very well. It was also the ecclesiastical centre of Egypt. The Bishop of Alexandria had direct authority over the whole Egyptian church. One of the most famous bishops of Alexandria was, of course, Saint Athanasius the Great. It was the site of the catechetical school of Alexandria, which was headed at one time by Origen. And there's a possibility that Gregory and his brother may have met or heard Saint Athanasius while they were there. Scholars aren't too sure about that, but it's definitely true that Athanasius was in Alexandria while Gregory and his brother were there, so they could have met. Now, in the year 348, Gregory leaves his brother Caesarius behind in Alexandria, and he goes off to Athens. Now, and he travels from Alexandria to Athens by sea, and this turns out to be a life-changing experience for St. Gregory, because he nearly lost his life. As he was travelling in his boat from Alexandria to Athens, he was caught in a violent storm near Cyprus, and his boat was badly tossed and nearly collided with another vessel, and Gregory nearly lost his life. And Gregory was deeply worried not so much because he would have lost his life, as he explains in his autobiography, but because he had not yet been baptized. And it was a common practice at that time to postpone your baptism till later on in life. So during this storm, he prostrated himself, he prayed fervently, he prayed to Christ that if he would deliver him from the storm, he would live for Christ from then on. And miraculously, the storm subsided. And when Gregory arrived in Athens, he made a profound commitment of himself to Christ, and he was baptized upon his arrival in Athens. So one of the distinctive things about his time in Athens is that he forms a very close friendship with Saint Basil, Basil of Caesarea. Now, they may have already had met during Gregory's earlier studies, but it's in Athens that the two form a very close and deep friendship that lasted for 30 years. And there's a wonderful description in his autobiography of his student life, his days as a student in Athens. He says, we lived, that is he and Basil, we lived in fear of God, aware that first things are first. How among the youth's elite, driven by recklessness, all racing around frantically in different gangs, we led a life of such calm, like a spring, so to speak, of sweet water, believed to exist beneath the bitter waters of the sea. And then a bit later he says, with Basil I shared my studies, my lodgings, and my thoughts. And if I might boast a little, we formed a pair famous throughout Greece. All things were held in common, and one soul united our two separate bodies. So they shared the house together, they heard lectures together, they engaged in academic discussions together, and they formed a very deep friendship that lasted for many years. But it was a friendship that was severely tested at one point, and I'll come back to this later, but they always remained close friends nonetheless. So I've got another quote there, but I won't read it, where he describes their shared commitment to pursue a life of virtue rather than chasing academic prestige. So Gregory spends 10 years, basically his 20s, in Athens, studying advanced rhetoric and literature. And he distinguished himself to such an extent that he was offered one of only three funded positions in Athens as a teacher of rhetoric. But he didn't take this up. He actually chose to go back to Nazianzus. Basil had left a bit earlier to Cappadocia. Then a short while later, Gregory did the same. And he was about 30 years of age at this stage, and he had spent 10 years abroad in pursuit of learning and wisdom. So he returns to Cappadocia. On his return to Nazianzus, he taught rhetoric for a short time. But then he made several visits to the monastic community that Basil had established in a place called Annecy in Pontus, in north of Cappadocia. And I've got a map here to show you where that is. So it's spelt differently by different authors. Annecy in Pontus. That's where Basil's monastic community was, and Gregory often went there when he needed a time of silence and recuperation. One of the things that Gregory and Basil did at this monastic community was to produce what's come to be known as the Philokalia, which is not the Philokalia that we now know today. This consisted of a collection of Origen's works. So this is how Gregory and Basil tried to preserve Origen's legacy for future generations. Now, a bit later, around the year 362, Gregory is ordained a priest. And I've put there grudgingly accepted ordination because he was pressured by his father to become a priest. And his father would have been at this time in his mid-80s. So he was getting on in years. And Gregory describes his ordination as a terrible shock, and he describes the tactics of his father as tyrannical behavior. So I'll just quote a passage from his autobiography where he says, "Although my father was well aware of my views, he forced me to accept a place inferior only to the bishop's throne, and I don't know why. I suffered such pain as a result of this tyrannical behaviour that all of a sudden I severed my ties with everything, friends, parents, home and family. I made for Pontus," that's Basil's monastic community in Pontus, "seeking a remedy for my pain from that holy friend of mine, namely Basil, for he was there practicing communion with God, concealed in a cloud like one of the wise men of old." So, as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that Gregory often did in a time of crisis was to flee, to take off. So he takes off to Pontus. But soon after, the following Easter, he returns, and this time he returns with a renewed sense of personal commitment to the priesthood. And over the next 10 years, in fact, he works at Nazianza, supporting his father, who was the bishop there, as well as supporting Basil in Basil's struggles with the Arians especially. So Basil also at this stage had become a priest, and then later on bishop of Caesarea. Also at this time with Basil, Gregory did a lot of philanthropic work. So this was a time, and we're talking about the late 360s, when Cappadocia suffered a severe famine. And Gregory played a key part in setting up a hospice and medical facility for the poor on Basil's family estate outside Caesarea, which Basil called the Ptochotrophion, it's become known later on as the Vasiliad. This is also a time when there were a series of family deaths in Gregory's family, which affected him deeply. So, firstly, his brother died in his mid-30s, then his cousin Ephemius died, then his sister died, and then her husband died. It was a very tragic period in his life. And this was followed by an even more momentous event in Gregory's life when he becomes bishop. And just to provide some context to this, the Roman Empire at this time was divided into two regions. You had the West and the East, and each region had its own emperor. The emperor of the East was someone called Valens, and he was against the Orthodox faith. He supported the Arians. So what he wanted to do was to diminish the authority of the Orthodox. So to do that, what he did was he employed the well-known divide and conquer strategy. He divided the big region of Cappadocia into two separate parts. One part, which was centered on Caesarea, he gave to Basil. The other part, he gave to an Arian bishop. So Basil, who was bishop of Caesarea, and by extension the whole of Cappadocia, suddenly found himself with half of his authority gone, half of his constituency diminished. And so what Basil tried to do was to recover some of this lost ground. And to do this, he would try to install as many bishops as he could around Cappadocia who would support him and who would help him fight Arianism. So one of the things that Basil did was he pressured his younger brother, Gregory of Nyssa, to become bishop of Nyssa. And he also, together with Gregory's father, persuaded Gregory to be ordained bishop. Now, and the see, the bishopric that was given to Gregory was a small village called Sasima. Now, Sasima was not anything, extraordinary. It was a very lowly village, but it was strategically important because it was at the crossroads of the two Cappadocian provinces. So it was very important to put someone there who would be loyal to the Orthodox Nicene faith, the faith of Nicaea. Now, how did Gregory respond to this? Well, he was furious. He reacted with resentment and anger towards Basil. He saw it as a betrayal of their friendship. He was resentful for a number of reasons. He was resentful partly because this would have taken Gregory, against his will, away from the quiet, contemplative life that he liked so much. But he was also resentful because he was put in charge of a see, namely the village of Sasima, which was of very little importance. It had no cultural attractions, no political importance. And Gregory gives a wonderful description of this village in his autobiography, where he says, he describes Sasima in these terms. He says, it's a place without water, without vegetation, completely uncivilized, an utterly dreadful and cramped little settlement. It's all dust and noise and chariots, cries and groans, officials, instruments of torture and shackles, a population consisting only of visitors and vagrants. This was Sasima, my congregation. So, not the most attractive place to be. And Gregory also felt that he was being used as a tool for the advancement of Basil's personal and political ambitions. And he has some very harsh words to say against Basil, and I'll just read some of them. After describing Sasima, he says, "So this was what he, Basil, appointed me to, he who was surrounded by 50 suffragan bishops. What magnanimity on his part." It's a very ironic. And in one of his letters, he writes to Basil. So this is a letter that he wrote to Basil. He writes, "The kindest charge against you is disdain and contempt. For our part, we draw one profit from your friendship, not to trust in friends and not to consider anything more valuable than God." But at the same time, Gregory always was very fond of Basil. So in another letter, he was to write, this is a letter to Basil, "I have considered you from the beginning my life's guide, my teacher of doctrine, and every other kind of good influence." And then later on he says, "If there is any benefit for me in living, it is your friendship and companionship." So even though their friendship was tested, they always remained close. So Gregory's reaction, though, was to this appointment was one of passive resistance. He never took up the appointment. He never went to Sasima, never lived there, never engaged in the affairs of the district where the church was, and never really got involved in Basil's ecclesiastical and political struggles. And his reaction, as was typical of Gregory, was to take off, to flee, as he puts it in his autobiography. "Once again, I turned fugitive and ran off into the mountains, secretly to find the life I loved and which was my delight." But his father had other ideas, and his father begged him to return to Nazianzus and to help him with his pastoral duties, this time as assistant bishop to his father. And Gregory gave in to his father's wishes. Now, not long afterward, his father died, around 100 years old, and about a few months later, his mother died. And so Gregory found himself in charge of the church of Nazianzus. But again, pastoral responsibility, especially in his native hometown, never sat easily with Gregory. So as soon as a successor was installed as bishop, he fled again. And this time he went to St. Thecla's monastery in a place called Seleucia, which is on the coast of the Mediterranean. And he stayed there for quite a while, for about 4 years, and he describes this as the happiest time of his life. But all this was to change quite dramatically. Now, again, just to provide some context to this, the emperor in the east, Valens, died. He was killed in a military battle. And then it was left up to the Western emperor to appoint a successor in the east. And the Western emperor appointed someone called Theodosius, who happened to be a devout Christian and an unequivocal supporter of the Nicene Confession. So in the standards of the day, he was entirely orthodox in his faith, and he was against Arianism. And he was largely responsible for calling Gregory up to go to Constantinople and to take charge of the small number of Christians who was still there. So one thing you have to remember was that in Constantinople at this time, the Orthodox were the minority. The clear majority at this time were the Arians. So there were, for example, a succession of emperors after Constantine who had been committed Arians. And also for some 40 years, there had been no Orthodox bishop in Constantinople. They were all Arians. So Theodosius wanted to change that, and he invited Gregory to take up the position of Bishop of Constantinople. And another important point to remember at this time was that in around about this time, Basil passed away, and it was now Gregory who was the leading spokesman for the Orthodox faith in Asia Minor. And so Gregory accepted the invitation to go to Constantinople, partly because he saw it as his duty now to take over Basil's role in the struggle for the survival of the Orthodox Christian faith. And there was a general hope that Gregory would be a moderating influence in the city. He would help to heal the schisms and the disunity in the city. And so he was seen as a force for peace and reconciliation. But he was not at this time the officially canonically ordained Bishop of Constantinople. Even when Theodosius appointed him Archbishop, Gregory said in response that, well, the matter has to wait until the council, which was being prepared for the following year, would confirm this appointment. Okay. So, in any case, in the year 380, Emperor Theodosius arrives in Constantinople. He takes up his residence there. He was in Thessaloniki originally. He expels the Arian bishop who was there at the time. And there's a wonderful description of in Gregory's autobiography of his grand entry into the city with the emperor and the procession to the Church of the Holy Apostles. And I'll just read a bit from his autobiography about this. He says, he begins, "The moment had arrived. The marketplaces were full, the colonnades, streets, every place, two and three-story houses were full of people leaning out, men, women, children, the very aged. There were scuffles, sobbing, tears and cries, all giving the impression of a town taken by force. I, the hero and the commander, with this sick and broken body of mine, which could hardly breathe anymore, caught between the general and the army, my gaze directed upwards, moved on, supported by hope, until I entered the church, I don't know how." And then a bit later he says, "Yet when I and the emperor in his purple majesty came within those awesome gates, God's praises rang out from all the people with one accord, as they addressed him with loud voices and hands outstretched. The gloom cleared from everyone's faces and spirits, and as their confidence increased at this vision, they cried out with all their strength, asking for me as if this were the one thing lacking to those present. It would be the first and greatest honour for the city if I were to be appointed to that city's throne. This was demanded by the men in high position and the less important. This was demanded by the women shouting from the upper gallery. There was an incredible thundering, an incredible thundering noise echoing off the walls. So a very memorable description of his entry into the capital, Constantinople. Now, his ministry there, it's interesting that when Gregory arrived, he didn't even have a church to use. That's how great the Arian dominance of Constantinople was. All the churches were in Arian hands. So what Gregory did was he converted a room in the house that he was using that belonged to his relatives. He converted that room into kind of makeshift, improvised chapel, which he dedicated to the Anastasia, the resurrection. And there was always great opposition from the Arians, the anti-Nicene faction, even to the extent that he was attacked with stones during a service during the church at Easter. And he says in his autobiography, "The city was seething with anger against me on the grounds that I was introducing many gods instead of one." So this was a reference to the accusations that the Arians made when Gregory was emphasizing the idea of God as Trinity. They took it the wrong way and interpreted him to be accepting belief in three gods. There was even an attempt made on his life. The would-be assassin confessed to him, and Gregory forgave him immediately, which won him even greater support around the city. Then there was a famous incident called the Maximus Conspiracy. I won't go into this in too much detail, but this bizarre character called Maximus, originally from Alexandria in Egypt, he arrived in Constantinople, gave the impression that he was a loyal supporter of the Nicene faith, that he would support Gregory. Gregory, in his naivety, bought this hook, line, and sinker, and before you know it, Maximus was undermining Gregory and trying to take his position as Bishop of Constantinople. But Maximus's plans were soon found out, and he was kicked out of Constantinople by the emperor. Now, so much of his work in Constantinople involved public speaking. He gave the famous five theological orations, which I'll come back to a bit later. He also served as president of the Council of Constantinople, which is now known as the Second Ecumenical Council. And overall, he spent about 18 months there. So the Second Ecumenical Council, which met in 381, its president was the Bishop of Antioch, Meletius, who actually passed away during the course of the council. The council was attended by 150 Orthodox bishops and 36 heretical bishops. The bishops were primarily from Asia Minor. Gregory of Nyssa, Basil's brother, also took part, and he actually gave the funeral oration for the deceased Maximus. Meletius, the deceased Meletius. And one of the first tasks on the council's agenda was to confirm the Bishop of Constantinople. So up to this time, Gregory had been kind of the acting Bishop of Constantinople. But Gregory's appointment was soon confirmed. Then, shortly after, Meletius died. And so Gregory unexpectedly found himself both Archbishop of the Imperial Capital and President of the most important church council under the new political regime under Theodosius. But soon a dispute arose as to who should succeed Meletius as Bishop of Antioch. Now Gregory had just had enough. He was weary of disputes and intrigues. And so he resigned his position as Archbishop and Council President. He gave an eloquent farewell speech to both the bishops and to the emperor. And he had been bishop of Constantinople for no more than 6 weeks. Now, the other item on the council's agenda was to put an end to the many theological controversies that were plaguing the church at this time. Now, so one important thing to note about the kind of society that existed back then is that this was a time when theological debates and controversies weren't just the preserve of some elite group, whether they be theologians, scholars, academics, bishops, or whatnot. Everybody engaged in theology, both laity and clergy, those who were well-educated and those not well-educated. And so people back then were much more theologically literate than people are today. They knew their theology much better than we do. And Gregory of Nyssa expressed this really well in a famous passage where he describes the passion for theology that existed in Constantinople at this time. And he says, well, if you ask someone in the marketplace the price of a loaf of bread, he will answer, the Father is greater and the Son is subordinate. So the one attempt that was made by the council to put an end to at least the negative aspects of this kind of theological controversy was to put forward what's called the Niceno-Constantinopolitan Creed, which is the creed that we now use and recite in the liturgy. You know, the one that begins, we believe in one God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, of all things visible and invisible. And it's the one statement of faith that is accepted as authoritative, not only by the Orthodox, but also by the Roman Catholics, Anglicans, and major Protestant churches. So Gregory gave up his position as Bishop of Constantinople and then returned to his home in his family property in Cappadocia. And there he devoted the remaining years of his life to being, you know, a man of letters. He would, you know, busy himself editing and rewriting his sermons. He would correspond with friends and people of influence in the empire. He would compose long autobiographical poems. He passed away around 389, 390, around 60 years of age, and we celebrate his feast day on January the 25th. His relics, I found out while doing some research for this talk, were originally in Azianzus. Then around the 10th century, they were transferred to Constantinople. But interestingly, they were transferred or, really, they were stolen by the Crusaders during the Fourth Crusade in 1204, and they were taken to Rome. And it was not until 2004 that these relics were returned to Constantinople, together with the relics of St. John Chrysostom. So it's a very interesting incident in the recent history of the Church. All right, now moving on to Gregory's writings, and I'll try and get through this as quick as possible. So Gregory didn't produce any kind of systematic theology. He wrote in a number of literary forms and genres. He composed many orations, including sermons and funeral orations, the most famous of which is the funeral oration he gave to his friend Basil. Many letters and much poetry as well, which I'll come back to in a minute. His most famous orations are the five theological orations, which he gave in Constantinople. And it's largely on the basis of these that he earned the title of the theologian. And the problem, the most important problem that they address is how are we to understand the doctrine of the Trinity? So the main question they address is, when we speak of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, do we think of each of them as God in the same sense? And I'll come back to what Gregory has to say about this in a minute. Then there are his autobiographical poems, which are remarkable for providing a very individual picture of the Byzantine world, but also for moments that are intimate, passionate, and moving. As I said, his the only other person who attempted this kind of thing was Augustine. And Gregory focuses especially on the troubles he experienced in Constantinople. And his main autobiography, which I've been reading from tonight, is called De Vita Sua, or My Life. And he wrote many autobiographical poems, but this was the longest one and the one which is of the greatest biographical, historical and theological interest. And again, he focuses on his troubles in Constantinople. Now, moving on to the one thing that he's best known for, namely his writings on the Trinity. Now, I've got a quote there. Well, I've got two quotes. One, which is from both from Gregory. The top one, he says, "When I say God, I mean Father, Son, and Holy Spirit." So Gregory stands out among Christian theologians of every generation for the clarity, the power, and the spiritual depth of his teaching on the Trinity. And his Trinitarian theology was developed mostly during his short time in Constantinople. So this shows just how much the intense demands of his office drew out his best theological work. And I've got one quote there from his fifth theological oration, which one recent scholar, Christopher Bealey, has described as possibly the most complete and nuanced definition of the Trinity in all of patristic literature. So I'll just read through it. He begins with a quote from the Gospel of John. "There was the true light which enlightens everyone who comes into the world, the Father. There was the true light which enlightens everyone who comes into the world, the Son. There was the true light which enlightens everyone who comes into the world, the Comforter or Holy Spirit. Was and was and was, but one thing was." In other words, these are three subjects and three verbs. He was and he was and he was, but a single reality was. "Light and light and light, but one light and one God. This is what David imagined long ago when he said, 'In your light we shall see light.' And now we have both seen and proclaimed the concise and simple theology of the Trinity. Out of light, the Father, we comprehend light, the Son, in light, the Spirit." So there's a lot there. But in to summarize, very briefly, Gregory, like the church as a whole, taught that God is a trinity of three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. God is one. Gregory variously states that the three persons are one God, Theos, one in divinity, Theotis, a single nature, Physis, or being, Ousia. But God is also three persons, and Gregory speaks of three hypostases or subsisting entities, hypostases, three persons, prosopa, and he also speaks of three unique things or characteristics, idiotites. Now, the important thing to note is that these words, especially words like substance and person, are used in a very different way from the way in which they're normally used when we talk about created things. So when we speak of water as a substance today, or when we speak of your friend as a person, we're using the words very in a similar but also a very different way from the way in which the theologians of the church use them in relation to God. Okay. But the important thing to note that this is not belief in three gods, tritheism, nor is it modalism, or otherwise known as the heresy of Sabellianism, which is the view that the three persons are merely you know, different modes or aspects or masks that God wears. So God is one, but God is three. And on that note, I'll finish up. So feel free to ask any questions.
Hi, I was just wondering, when you said that St. Gregory's mother dedicated him to the church, what exactly did she do? Because he wasn't given to the church like Panagia was. He wasn't raised in the church. He wasn't even baptized until he's 30. So what?
Raised in the church, though he wasn't baptized until later.
So who actually raised him? When you say raised in the church, was he given over to the church? Or
well, Gregory saw this as a prefiguration of what lay ahead. And I didn't mention this, but when he was in his teens, he says in his autobiographies that he had a vision, which was a life-changing experience for him. He had a vision of what he called chastity and temperament, and they were kind of bidding him to follow in their footsteps. And so he thought, if he saw that as a kind of a calling to a life of celibacy. So he was always raised in the Christian faith, but it was common back then, like I said, to delay baptism till later. So does that answer?
Yeah, sure. No, yeah. I just wasn't sure. I mean, since they were such a Christian family, and the father was a priest anyway. I'm just not sure how it was an extra dedication to God. That's all.
Dedicated in the sense that this was someone who was not going to lead the ordinary life like his brother did of, you know, getting married or his sister getting married or his brother pursuing a career in medicine and amassing, you know, a personal fortune, but it was to lead a different kind of life. So separate.
So that really would have been up to God to instill in him, I guess, in a way.
Of course.
Because that's not something that the mother could never have known that he would have been what he became, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, that's a...
But anyway, that's getting complicated.
I guess so.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
I have two questions.
Yep.
The first question is, when you were narrating his family, you mentioned that his father was married.
Yep.
And his father was an assistant bishop.
Yep.
So was there a time in the church's history where bishops were married?
Yes. His father was a bishop. He was an assistant bishop. His father was a full-fledged bishop.
But was his father married?
Yes. It was common at that time. Well, not common, but it wasn't unusual to find married bishops.
Okay. And the second question was, you said that he was not very favourable to the idea of becoming a bishop from his friend Basil.
Yeah.
Isn't it normal practice of the synod, a grace to a person becoming a bishop, not just one particular person? I was always under the impression that the synod makes a decision who will become a bishop. Or am I mistaken in saying that?
Yeah, what really happened is Basil made kind of the first moves to get him appointed bishop, in collusion with Gregory's father. But nothing could happen until the synod met and confirmed this. That's why even when the emperor called into Constantinople and said, you know, I want to make you archbishop, Gregory said, well, you can't. The decision has to be made by the synod. So Gregory took up the role of kind of the shepherd of the Orthodox congregation, but he wasn't officially bishop until the council confirmed it.
With the opportunity, if I can ask a question.
Yes.
I'm just curious to know, with Origen, did St. Basil and St. Gregory know of the condemnation of the ecumenical councils? And if they did they comment about it at all? Are you aware of any, what they thought of the things where Origen went astray on a couple of points?
Yeah, I'm not really too sure about that. I mean, Origen, one thing I didn't mention was Origen was very influential, but he was also a very controversial figure. So, and he was charged with various heresies after he had passed away. But it's interesting, I think, that he himself was never considered a heretic, but only parts of his teachings were deemed heretical. But I'm not sure what Gregory and Basil had to say about that. That would be interesting to look into. But it's important to bear in mind this was a time when, well, Origen anyway was writing at a time in the late 2nd century, early 3rd century, so this is before Gregory, when you could say the limits of what is acceptable, doctrinally, theologically acceptable, weren't really set clearly the way they were in later centuries. So there was kind of more room in a way to, more ways to go wrong, you could say, when Origen was writing. And so it wasn't surprising to find someone of that great theological ability to make various mistakes. But he was widely considered to be a very holy and pious person. But I'm not really sure about the answer.
Oh, I was just wondering, the five theological orations you said were in Constantinople,
yep,
towards the end.
Yep.
But you said earlier that he was the second after St. Basil in terms of clout around that time.
Yeah,
what was
yeah.
he doing at the time that made that? So,
well, he was giving a lot of other orations as well, and he had established a reputation as a great orator way before then. And that was partly why he was called up to Constantinople. And he was seen as someone who could exercise his rhetorical abilities to end the schisms in Constantinople. So he was a great orator. But it was the five theological orations where he really proved himself. And it was actually that on its own consolidated and strengthened the Orthodox faith in Constantinople and really turned things around. So it was a major achievement.
So when he did orations, was it just a group of people that were gathered, or was it at particular places?
I think, well, we're talking about orations, sermons, basically, given in church on various occasions. But what he did was later in life, when he went back home, he heavily edited these. So the ones that we have now are reworked and, you know, expanded and enlarged.
So, okay, thank you. Yep.
You stated that he was baptized in his 30s, and that was a common thing back then. I'm just wondering, given he was brought up in a Christian family, why he wasn't baptized earlier and why that was such a common thing?
One of the main reasons for that is why it was so common in those early centuries is that, as you may all know, that when someone is baptized, all sin is washed away. So not only the consequences of the original sin and everything related to that, but also all personal sin. So even today when we catechize and prepare adults for baptism, we tell them that all the sins you've committed throughout your whole life up until that day are washed away in baptism. So one of the reasons that they delayed it was what a wonderful thing to be baptized later, before you die, like Emperor Constantine, as Nick just explained, who accepted baptism on his deathbed, so that when he died, he was pure. And we often tell adults, you're never going to be as pure as you are on the day of your baptism. So, you know, but the church actually started to speak against that practice because of the danger, as St. Gregory found, that one could very quickly and easily die and not be baptized. And so the concern was with that. So the church basically said, look, let's stop this as a common practice and let's encourage people to be baptized as soon as possible. And so now we have the common practice of infant baptism, which still took place back then, but wasn't quite as common.
So does that mean they couldn't participate in communion and the other sacraments of the church?
That's right, yes. They couldn't, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does that mean that prior to getting married or getting involved in any of the sacraments, they had to be baptized then? Because you can't.
Although marriage was different back then than what it is today. Marriage wasn't as formalized as what it is today. I don't remember. I have read about it, but I don't remember the details of how it took place. Have you read
about
that?
Sure.
Yeah. But it wasn't as formalized in the way we have the sacrament today.
But it was done.
For example, now I'm not absolutely certain about this. For example, it may have been as something as simple as just turning up to the church and just having a prayer read over you and off you go sort of thing. But it may not have been as simple as that. But if anyone has read about the early practice of marriage, anyone know? Anyone read about it? Okay. So I can say whatever I like and you wouldn't have a clue. Okay. Yeah. I don't know, but I know it wasn't as formalized as what it is today. Yeah.
Thanks, Pater. Thank you, Nick, for a wonderful talk. That's absolutely wonderful, because St. Gregory the Theologian's always been a very special saint in my life. I'll just share with you something practical that we read from his books, but we actually have to learn from the Yayadas as well. Because I was in a monastery in northern Greece, in Drama, we were actually very close to Kavala. And just a bit further north of Kavala, going towards Constantinople, there's a village called Nea Karvali. Karvali, as Nick mentioned, was the property that St. Gregory's family owned. And when the exchange of populations happened, the Turks kicked out the Greeks in the 1920s, from Cappadocia, the people grabbed their treasured possessions, which were the icons, the big church candlesticks, the relics of the saints, and they fled with those. So I was blessed with living in Greece for years, close to the relics of St. Gregory the Theologian. Nick mentioned that the Pope gave some relics back. He only gives a piece. And it's a token thing, because these saints get chopped up into pieces and they go all over the place. We hardly ever have all of the relics of one saint in one place. So I had the blessing to live 1 hour's drive from the village of Nea Karvali. And any village in Greece that's called Nea Karvali, Nea Poloniada, Nea Mudania, were named after the original villages that were in Pontus or in Cappadocia, in the places that were seized and when they were kicked out by the Turks. So the village of Nea Karvali has the relics of St. Gregory the Theologian. And so we would frequently, with the sisters, go for an afternoon drive and go and visit. And a lot of the little yayadas would have all-night vigils there. They'd fast, they'd pray. They'd make pilgrimages from the villages all around there on the donkey or by foot to go to St. Gregory to pray. Also, he had a very intimate relationship with St. George, the new confessor, who's the saint who was proclaimed as a saint 2 years ago from my monastery in Greece. St. George Karslidis, who was also from Pontus, from Asia Minor. He was persecuted over there because of his Christian faith, and they actually call him Oneos Omologitis. He actually ended up founding my monastery, and he died in 1959. Now, he was a very humble monk who lived the contemplative life, and people would come to him and ask him to pray for them in the life and the miracles that I actually heard, the others that actually had him as a spiritual father. He was very humble, because he would say, someone had someone say, please pray for my child because they're blind, or someone because they're paralyzed, and that. And he said, go to Ayo Grigori at Nea Karvali, and when you go there, you'll be healed. A lot of the saints did that because they had, even though they were in different centuries, they had that living faith between them. It's a humility on St. George's part, not saying I made you well, because he was a priest in the village where my monastery is, in Drama, in Sipsa. And he would send people to Ayo Grigori. So we sisters, even though we had relics of the saints in our monastery, we had the grave of St. George Karslidi, who's just been proclaimed a saint. When we had a headache, when we had something, we would go for the afternoon to Ayo Grigori to make us better. We'd get lathi there, we'd cross our kubuskini or our things on St. Gregory's tomb. So the Pope might have given a piece back, but the actual place where there's the living faith is in Nea Karvali, which is, if you go to Kavala in northern Greece, just outside of that, the next one of the next villages on the coast going towards Constantinople, that's where his stuff's brought from. And the icons, the original icons were the big candlesticks. I don't know how they brought them out, how many people were slaughtered by the Turks, but they brought all their faithful stuff. So if you go to Greece, go and visit him up north. Lexi. Thank you, Pater. I just thought, Nick and Brother, I thought I'd just add that, because a lot of time we read the lives of saints, but we here in Australia miss out the practical living them. Going there, chanting their paraklesi, going there to their feast day, you know, and seeing people with the miracles that happen. We do a bit more thing just reading about things. When you go to pilgrimages overseas, it's really nice to live it. So that's it. Thank you for sharing that. It's really wonderful to, for me to sort of fill in the bits that I didn't know, even though I've read a lot about him. Now, what if I had an announcement? Just like to announce our Panagiri, the feast day of the monastery, is on the 1st of October. It's just a few more weeks' time. It falls on a Friday. So if anyone can take a... I won't say a sickie, if anyone can take a... what do you take?
RDO.
On the Friday and come. On the evening before, on the Thursday evening, we have the Vespers service at 7 o'clock. And on the Friday, we'll have the liturgy service. Again, this year, we'll be in the tent, that lovely tent. It's actually, it's got a lot of God's grace there because it's just an ordinary tent with clear sides. There's no deblo, so you can actually see the liturgy happening, which is actually very moving. We actually enjoy it, except we kill ourselves setting it up and unsetting it. So it's actually very nice. Nearly every year, we have storms, big storms. Roofs get blown off in Geelong. Trees get fallen down, and every year our tent stays up. And the people come and they say, I don't know why, your tent, we never have any problems with it. And we say, well, we're not having a party, and we're having a church service, so God's blessing us. So please pray for us for our feast day in a few weeks on the 1st of October. And also pray for us, we need your prayers as well, because our builders have come back after having a break for a while. We ran out of money and then we saved up a bit more, we've got them back. And they're actually trying to build and progress the building of our church so that eventually we can move in. And unfortunately, we've been praying for rain and we're getting a lot of rain. So we don't want rain on our building site. Okay, everybody? Please pray for the rain to be off our building site. We're lucky we're on the side of the hill. We're not flooding and it just runs down and floods Corio and Nor Lane down below. So please pray for us that we can do the right things with our builders and progress. We have enough finances now to do the slab in the basement, then the walls, and then the big slab. The big slab's got a heating in the floor, and about that much wall. So we need prayers so that we don't make any mistakes, and we need your support to help us to build the rest of the church. I've also got, with Father Chris's blessing and the bishop's blessing, some little pink pamphlets that we've got. You've probably seen them before. They've got a postcard that's got a picture of Panagia Goropikos, an icon of Panagia, and a picture of the little model that we've got of the church. And there's a little pink form. If any of you can help or have any functions from your youth groups or anybody can think of donating something to help us to build the church, it'd be really very much appreciated. Be careful, though. Don't grab your mum's sewing machine and put it on eBay to support us. There's a friend of ours who the husband just picked up her sewing machine and sold it on her. And he was cleaning up the house and she said, I want that sewing machine. He said, for 1 year now you haven't used it, that's it, I'm getting rid of it. So don't go and sell mum's sewing machine. So thank you very much. And thanks very much again, Nick, for the excellent talk. And we'll see you next door in the hall for a cuppa. Thanks, Father Jennifer.
Through the prayers of St. Gregory the Theologian and of our Holy Fathers, Lord Jesus Christ, our God, have mercy on us and save us. Amen. May God bless you all and keep you well.